Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This started a long life of group homes, detention centers, and ultimately prison.
At what point did they intervene? Why didn't they intervene?
It's a situation that I would not want to find myself in. I would never want to get attacked, and I would never want to have to defend myself by killing somebody.
And the big question we always ask, John, is justice been served here?
This is True Crime Cast.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie back in the booth with John to cover a case that I don't know that I'm ready for. It's a wild ride. How are you, man?
Man, I'm doing good. It feels like it has been a year since we've seen each other, but we've had some COVID issues. I've had some COVID issues. Everybody's good now, but we're finally able to be back in the booth again.
Yeah, it's been a while. Quarantine has not treated us well, but we appreciate our listeners for continuing to listen and to write those reviews that we mentioned in our last episode. We're going to start reading some of those. So if you would, I'm going to just give some thank yous to some of the recent reviews we've gotten. Joe over on Facebook says, just introduced my daughter to this podcast. Love it. Kate says, thank you, Joe.
Sorry to cut you off, but thank you, Joe.
Just started binging the podcast and I'm really digging it. I'm pretty picky and don't always get past the first few episodes, but you guys know how to cover a case and keep my attention. Thank you, Kate.
Kate, appreciate it.
And then Mel, I love these guys. Listen to the podcast every single day as I'm a new listener. I could not recommend this podcast enough. I absolutely love it so much. So those are some of our recent top reviews over on Facebook. So thanks to Mel for that one. We really appreciate it, guys. And as new ones come in, we're going to bump those to the top of the list that we're going to read at the top of every episode.
Yep. While those are very appreciated over on Facebook, we also appreciate if you take your time to do those on Apple. And those go a long way. While we're handing out thank yous, I want to say thank you to Jake for coming in at a $3 level over on Patreon. Thank you, Jake.
Jake's going to get that bonus episode every week. And we recorded the episode that's coming out February 1st a long time ago. It's really good. It's a good one.
Yeah, we are very excited about that one. Give us a little teaser. What's that one going to be about, Jamie?
Yeah, on this month's episode, we talk about serial killer John Jubert, who had murders in many different states and may or may not have had a run-in with a chair that has electricity. So you don't want to miss that one and the story of his crimes and how he was ultimately caught.
Now that sounds like it would be a really old case, but it's really not. And I think that was one of the surprising things. But anyway, there's a little teaser for Patreon coming up on February 1st. Don't forget, we have a ton of other stuff over there. So if you sign up today, you'll have instant access to our entire catalog over there. So, all right, we've done enough housekeeping there. Jamie, why don't you get us rolling? I will say before you get started, like, there is some very outlandish stuff in this case. So I'm probably going to be very interrupty today, and we'll kind of talk about just how crazy some of this stuff is.
Yeah, you're right. And you mentioned that you felt like the John Jubert case was a long time ago. I feel the same way about this one. When I first started researching it, I was like, oh, this is like a colonial case. This is early 1900s or something like that.
I was thinking like Victorian era when I started researching it, but it's not.
That's not. It is very contemporary. So let's go back and look at this case. Over the last decade, the De Vedrine family was at the center of a story that's been described as kind of a mix between like the Da Vinci Code, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter. I would even throw like National Treasure in there. Like it's one of those type of movies, it seems.
Absolutely. Now say the last name of the family one more time.
De Vedrine.
Okay. So obviously we're not in Kentucky. So I think we're going to be over in France. So I'm going to go ahead and apologize ahead of time for my mispronunciations.
Yeah. We appreciate Mackenzie giving us that phonetic guide, but John, you just do your best, buddy.
I'm going to try.
This family was a Protestant aristocrat family who could trace their title back three centuries. The patriarch of the family had three children, Philippe, Guilaine, and Charles Henry. And each of the children were married, and Mr. De Vedrine had five adult grandchildren. They all lived together in this mansion. It was kind of like an estate, and they called it Chateau Martel, and it was in the southeastern part of France. Now, there's always something happening at the Chateau Martel, dancing in the Grand Salon, birthday feasts at their ancient oak table, kids running around. everywhere. Like, this was a happening place to be, whether they were hosting or it was just the family there, because there were so many family members that lived there. They were very wealthy, considered to be very cultured, a big part of, I guess, that area. They were very well known and very intelligent. And that's what makes it so hard to believe what we're going to say happened to them. And they got brainwashed for a decade and ended up losing almost their entire fortune.
Yeah. When you said intelligent, that is actually the last thing that came to my mind when we're going to go down through here. So tensions had been building in the family for a while over inheritances and some troubling dynamics in the family. I tell you what, nothing will get your feathers ruffled like an inheritance gone bad.
Especially if there's a lot up there to lose, right? Now, like, if you're inheriting debt, you're not necessarily fighting over that as much. But if there's a lot of money to be had, you want your piece of the pie.
I won't go into the details here, but I've seen this firsthand, and it gets ugly real quick. But anyway, so they're dealing with the tensions there. Now, they were perfectly vulnerable when a con man named Terry Tilly entered their lives. Tilly was a man of little charm. He resembled a French version of Bill Gates. I think Bill Gates is a perfectly charming human being, Kenzie. I don't know what's up with that.
Well, I think it's just a matter of not a big boisterous personality, kind of a boring guy that, you know, was helpful and certainly had some wisdom to bring. And that's what he said he would bring to their family, but just not that, didn't make that big impression on you when you first met him.
In 1999, 66-year-old Guylaine hired Tilly to work for her in a secretarial college in Paris. Now, she barely noticed him at first, but gradually she grew closer to Tilly. She began even confiding in him. She told Tilly that her husband, Jean, was depressed and her son, Francis, was a failure. Now, her family was a mess, and Tilly was happy to listen to her. They had grown so close that Guylaine's husband started to believe that they were actually having an affair. In the mid-2000s, sometime in that year, she introduced Tilly to the whole family. This family was really impressed with some of Tilly's stories. He claimed to be like a descendant of the famous Habsburg family and the son of an Olympic ice skater. And it was at this dinner that 35-year-old Tilly told the family that his job at the secretarial school was merely a cover, that he was actually a special agent in the service of France. So, I mean, right off the bat here, he's telling some pretty outlandish stories. He did this a lot growing up, too. Like, we don't know a whole lot about him growing up, but he would, like, oftentimes tell kids at his school these outlandish stories.
Big imagination, and while he didn't have that big personality, he had a way of drawing people in to where they would trust him, and he could earn their trust and then start dropping these fantastical stories on them, and they're all of a sudden believable when they wouldn't have been before.
Now, he would go on to tell him that he had connections in NATO and that the family was welcome to call on him for anything they needed. So it seems like they were gullible enough to believe that this guy was who he said he was and that they were also connected by association.
Again, like you said, this is not Victorian times, right? This is the mid-2000s. So somebody asked Tilly about what line of work he was actually in, and he said, espionage, I can't discuss it. Then he would put his hand up and say, don't even ask me. He said his chief affiliation was an obscure humanitarian organization called the Blue Light Foundation. And when he was in social gatherings and his phone rang, he would check to see if it was somebody that he always called his president, a man named Jacques Gonzalez. If it was Gonzalez, Tilly would make it a point to let everybody know that he had to find a private place to take this call because it was super covert and secretive. And he was really convincing. And soon, not only did Tilly have Guylaine's trust, but he convinced the entire Dave Adrien family that their lives were in danger. He told them they were being bugged, they were being followed, that they were spies of an evil network that was out to get them, and that even included inside members of their family. So he goes from this guy working with Guylaine to somebody coming in and saying, hey, look, I'm a spy. I know something's about to happen to your family. I'm your only way to get out of this.
If you and I like didn't know each other very well, and I worked with you at your job, and I started telling you some of this stuff, like, what's your gut reaction to that going to be?
I mean, this doesn't strike me as very different from the Nigerian prince emails we get, right? Like, I have a prince who has died. If you pay off his Kia, he will fund your life forever. But again, Tilly had built up this trust with Guileen, so that makes it a little different for this family. And they're all so tight-knit that they trust somebody that she trusts. And I don't want to say I get it, but this isn't the first case we've discussed with people being brainwashed. This is a real thing, and he was able to give them what they wanted to hear to get them to follow his every move.
I guess, I mean, it's easy to sit here and judge this family 2020 hindsight, but I mean, we both know or both have people in our lives that we're just super skeptical around. We don't believe everything they say. So I don't know. It would take a lot for me to build up my trust in you enough to believe some of this outlandish stuff. But so let's talk about it. So Tilly convinced the family that they were the lost descendants of an ancient society called the Balance of the World. Now, this is an offshoot of the Knights Templar. So he told the family they were lost descendants of this ancient society. Tilly told them that a secret Masonic order wanted the family's wealth, and they were going to kill the family in order to get their money. Now, he told them that he alone could protect them. He claimed that he was protected by a global network ran by Gonzalez, who was a cousin to King Juan Carlos of Spain. Tilly claimed Gonzalez was giving instructions directly to Tilly, who was then meant to personally guide the family on what they should do.
Okay, I get it. This family's rich, they have influence, they have power, but is there anybody really rich enough that this Knights Templar group, I guess we're talking Illuminati at this point, if there's a group that runs the world behind the scenes, do they really want like one individual family's money? I don't think that that's a motivation for them.
Or if that is true, would you only want one individual protecting your entire family?
Like, yeah, that's, I mean, Tilly, where's your friends? Where are your other espionage buddies?
Get some more secret society members that you're in cahoots with and then come back and protect our family.
Yeah, come protect our team. But again, going back to this family's already kind of at odds over the inheritance. So protecting the money is their focus, and they think they have to do this. Over the next 2 years, the head teacher at that secretarial school in Paris said that large sums of money started just being drained from this school's account. In fact, the school got their bank balance so low that it couldn't even pay the bills. Guileen dropped a worrisome amount of weight, wore sunglasses indoors, and warned the staff to be on the lookout everywhere for these Freemasons that were out to kill them. Tilly ended up moving into a ground floor of the school. He moved in with them. He hired a large Polish guard to patrol the school with a Rottweiler. This is all to reinforce his story, right? One day, Tilly put the school on lockdown because Gonzalez was coming to visit Guileen. Not one person got a look at him, though. He didn't actually show up, and Guileen was convinced that something had just come up. By March of 2001, the school had stopped paying almost all of its staff, and soon the school had to shut down altogether. Amidst all this chaos, Tilly had also convinced Guileen to leave her husband, Jean. Jean then tried to warn his wife that Tilly was a charlatan and he wasn't to be trusted, and he was probably even a pervert. Then one day later that year, in September of 2001, Jean was in the living room of the summer house when Guileen stormed in. She was dressed for a cocktail party. She was carrying a handful of dried flowers. She had a gardening glove on. She ended up throwing the flowers and the glove in her husband's face and just started screaming at him, like things that didn't even make sense. She said the dried flowers were a sign that he was part of the evil network. So Tilly had convinced Guileen that her husband was a part of this group looking to kill them, and he was dumbfounded. During this tirade, Guileen's brothers grabbed a hold of Jean and gave him an hour to pack and to leave their family and never turn back and come again. By the time he reached his destination, the bank accounts that he had shared with his wife that were obviously full of money because they were rich were completely drained. So they kicked him out of the family and took all his money and just kind of left him by the side of the road on his own. Eventually, he got access to Guileen's computer where he found an email from Tilly with the following instructions. Throw the flowers and the glove at him. Tell him that there are signs that he's in the evil network and then give him an hour to pack. So these instructions came directly from Tilly, and she's confronting her husband as being a part of the group that's out to get them. Now, it's obvious that Tilly's really in control of this entire situation. And after the break, we'll talk about how much crazier this story really gets.
Now, the family was firmly under the impression that they were in danger. And I do want to emphasize that, because if you believe that you're in danger, believing some of the stuff that he's putting out there makes it a little bit more understandable, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's when you go into survival mode, and logic stops making sense a lot of the time when you're just trying to stay alive.
So they began to abandon their lives and routines, and three generations of this family began barricading themselves behind the closed doors and shutters of their mansion. Tilly convinced the family to remove all clocks, all calendars, you know, anything like that from the home. He said that you didn't, like, time didn't apply to you anymore.
What does that even mean?
It feels like a casino. Like, when you go into a casino, there's no clocks, there's no windows. And that's exactly what's happening here. Time is irrelevant. The only thing that matters is their protection.
You got to think this is just a way of him, like, gaslighting them to try to get more psychological control. I can't think of any practical reason you wouldn't want them to know what time it is, but here we are.
I mean, could you imagine being one of these family members and just being thoroughly convinced that your life was so in danger that you had to lock yourself in your house never to see daylight again? Like, no. That's absurd, psychologically speaking.
Yeah, I can't fathom what was going through their minds. And at this point in the story, they're like, Tilly's controlling this family, and there's very little they can do to get out from it, at least at this point. But he is in complete control, convincing them to get rid of their calendars and clocks. What?
Well, it gets worse, because he convinced one of them to leave her new husband. And not only that, but to give all of their money to Tilly. So this newlywed couple has to split off. Her husband leaves and goes away, and then she dumps all the money over to Tilly. So not just clocks and calendars, but your love lives too.
Clocks, calendars, cash, and marriage, apparently.
So the oldest brother, Charles, now he walked away from a medical practice and didn't even notify his patients that he was leaving. He just straight up abandoned the practice. Then he and his wife, Christine, sold their home and gave all the money to Tilly. I mean, Jamie, he's a freaking doctor. Like, he's one of the smartest people in the world, and he bought it. He fell for this.
Yeah, I mentioned that this was an intelligent family, and that's not just in a matter of, like, they've been intelligent enough to build this wealth, but also to go through medical school. And, I mean, not only is he too smart to, you would think, be brainwashed like this, but this family's victims, right? I want to be clear about that. But also, he's probably pretty wealthy on his own, being a physician.
Yeah. So you can imagine that when you fall off the radar like this, people are going to try to reach out to you. And Christine's friends tried to reach her by phone for more than a year, and she only answered the phone one time. And in that time she answered, she said, "I can't tell you anything. It's family business. It's very serious. I may come back, but in a different way. If I were you, I would be very worried." That is such a, like, if I called you and you told me something like that, like, I'm coming over and I'm taking care of business.
Yeah, I would think that you've had some kind of mental break with reality, and legitimately this family kind of has. "I may come back in a different way." That's a line.
What does that mean?
I don't know if that means they may come back as new leaders of this society Tilly's convinced them they're part of, or they may come back as peasants because they've gotten rid of all their money. It's baffling, but that one line has stood out to me throughout this entire case.
So, Jamie, these people lived in this barricaded castle and barely left for 5 years. I can't imagine, like, you know, I don't want to go too much into my personal life, but I just told you we had some COVID stuff. Like, I was quarantined for 5 days and I went nuts.
Absolutely.
So for 5 years, no, like, I'm going to lose my mind. So Tilly telephoned, faxed, or emailed them around 40 times a day from England, and he demanded updates on all their activities while he was persuading them to pour all of their money into the Blue Light Foundation to pay for their protection.
Yeah, so he called them and emailed them And he also faxed them, which also throws the time frame off for me. We really faxing people around 2010?
I mean, I still fax people today, but it's like maybe once every 6 months.
Caveman. You're a cave person.
My staff fax people all the time to request stuff.
I get that there's some level of security, but it feels antiquated to me. Regardless, Tilly was running into some legal troubles in France. So he convinced the entire family, who he had said, barricade yourselves in this castle. Give me all your money. I'm going to protect you. He's having trouble really managing that legally. So he's like, you know what? You guys need to get out of France. Come to England with me and I'll take care of you there, because it's so much more dangerous in France because they know where you are. He said they had to empty all of their accounts, sell everything they owned, and to put all the proceeds into this protection fund with the Blue Light Foundation. In reality, Tilly and Gonzalez were using the money to fund a really lavish lifestyle in London. Once the family got to the UK, things got even worse. Tilly convinced everybody that Charles Henry's wife, Christine, was literally the key to the great hidden treasure. So this is where I go back to the Da Vinci Code, to National Treasure. He convinced them that her maiden name translated to transmission of metals. And that was enough to convince the whole family that she knows the key. She has the bank number installed in her brain in Brussels that's going to allow you to access all these funds from your historical family that you're a part of, that's going to allow you to protect yourself. He told the family that she was the one to lead them to a secret that would not only save their family, but save the world from this group of Knights Templar trying to get back at them. Again, I want to thank our writer Mackenzie for this, not necessarily Dan Brown, who wrote The Da Vinci Code.
They sent Christine to Brussels to find the treasure. Now, while she was gone, the family survived by taking on menial jobs. Charles, who again was a trained doctor, worked as a gardener. The children worked as waitresses and even retail workers, and some of them even resorted to scavenging outside supermarkets. So in Jellicoe and in Harlan, we call that dumpster diving. Like, you're going through the trash just to find food in order to feed yourself and your family.
And again, this was one of the wealthier families in France just a few years earlier, before they had given all their money to Tilly.
Now, Christine came back, and she came back empty-handed because really she had no idea what she was looking for or where to find it. Tilly flew into a rage in front of the whole group of them and accused Christine of being responsible and withholding the account information. So he decided that because of this, she should be punished. So 58-year-old Christine's husband, Charles, and Guileen were ordered to take turns keeping her awake.
Before you go further into the torture, John, let's catch up here. We got this rich family, and we've got this guy, Tilly, who comes in, and he kind of weasels his way in and earns their trust. He drops this big bomb on them, right? There's this conspiracy theory. People are out to get you. Give me your money. So far, we see some con man stuff. We see him stealing money, breaking up relationships, convincing people of what we would consider ridiculous notions, because he essentially has psychological control over them. But this is where it really gets physical and takes another step further. So I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, I'm glad you did, because I was thinking the same thing. Like, up until this point, like, I don't know, I don't ever want to say anything negative about a victim, but like, I don't know, it gets really real right here. And I feel even more sorry for the family, just if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. You know what I
mean? Yeah. So again, this punishment. So they would have to pinch her earlobes as she was sitting on a stool with her hands folded in front of her. They didn't want her to go to sleep. Their job was to keep her awake. So by pinching her earlobes, that's what they were trying to do. Now, in the beginning of this punishment, she was able to drink some tea and ate some cookies, but they took away that, and they also took away her bathroom privileges. So she stopped drinking. She was forced to urinate in front of her husband and sister-in-law, and then her son was forced to clean it up. I mean, this is just psychological warfare, and I mean, I can't even imagine what these people, like, every one of them involved. I mean, you're hurting your own family to keep her awake. If you're her, you're being hurt by your own family, and you're humiliated when you urinate on yourself, and then your son has to clean it up. I mean, this whole thing is just awful.
And at this point, it doesn't seem like they're even questioning anything he says. They're like, yeah, you want us to pinch her earlobes to make her pee in front of us? That's what you say, Tilly. That's what we have to do.
So Tilly would come into the room and he would threaten Christine. He would say things like, you'd never are going to see your children again, those kinds of things. She was actually even drugged and then beaten and deprived of food for months. This is not just something that, you know, the food deprivation wasn't just for a day or two, but months. Now, she has been so brainwashed that she also believes that she holds the secret bank account number. She hates that she can't remember something that she must know, so she makes up an account number, and then they let her go back to her life. Just insane, man.
So Tilly knew that she didn't have an account number. He made this whole thing up. Why would he let her go back to her life when she came forward with this number? Is this just a way of him showing the rest of the family that he had the power to bring that out of her? Because he knows it's not real. Just another twist in the story.
Until they take her back to Brussels and lead her up and down the streets from bank to bank, trying to fake the account number and then being denied each time. Like, he lets it even go a step further by actually letting her go into banks and trying to get money out with this fake code that doesn't exist.
Absolutely incorrigible. In the spring of 2009, Christine was working. Again, she was allowed to work outside the house now that she had given up the number, for a guy named Robert Puget de Saint Victor in a cheese shop in Oxford. Robert started to notice, just based on things that Christine had been saying, the way she talked, that she had come from wealth. She at one point had been rich, but was obviously having some hard times. He tried to ask her what had happened to her money. Christine told her that her son had possession of the money and she didn't have access to it anymore. She also told Robert that there had been trouble in the family and that her son was no longer speaking to her. She was really vague, saying she couldn't tell him everything, but maybe someday she would let him in on all of her secrets. And he just kept pushing. He just kept pushing every day at work until Christine finally broke down and told Robert what was happening, about the torture, the trip to Brussels, the money they had lost, and the possessions they had all given to Tilly, and the story that he told them as to why they needed his protection. She also said she was still, she felt guilty for not being able to remember this bank number. But then he straight up told her, you don't remember because this isn't a memory. This is all made up. He told her to reach out to her son, and she said that she was afraid because she thought that her calls were being traced. So she ended up taking Robert's phone, put it on speaker, and they called, and her son got really hostile with her immediately. He called her a bore and a nightmare. And so Robert took the phone and started arguing with him, eventually hanging up on him. Robert spent the rest of that night reading French newspaper articles to catch up about this family's history, the stories that had happened back where they were from. And of course, since they were so high profile, journalists had covered their fall from the top and their disappearing. So he decided then that he had to help Christine to escape from England if she was ever going to be free of this spell that her family was under.
He asked Christine who she might be able to call for help, and she said that she had an old friend in Bordeaux. So they called her, and within days, Christine was back in France. Once home, she met with a lawyer named Daniel Picton, who is also known as an anti-cult crusader, which is a pretty cool thing to be known for. They took her story to the police, and a European warrant was issued for Tilly. On October 21st, 2009, Tilly made a trip to Zurich, and that trip would change everything. Swiss authorities arrested Tilly at the airport on charges of fraud, imprisonment accompanied by acts of barbarianism, and torture, extortion of fraud of funds, and abuse of weakness.
I like that charge.
I've never heard of any of those charges.
Abuse of weakness. I really like that. I think that speaks to the spirit of a law and that you're taking advantage of people, not just abusing somebody, but you're taking advantage of them. I like that.
So he was sent back to France in order to face prosecution. His accomplice, Gonzalez, was arrested in 2010. And just like every con man before him, Tilly was lying about his entire background and where he came from. He was actually born in 1964 in a suburb of Paris. He studied law, but he never finished his degree. He was married to a woman named Jessica, who was reported to be a cosmetics or advertising executive or even a model. Tilly had been involved in many dubious business activities over the years, with many former associates claiming that he had scammed them too. He was not a spy, and he was never related to the Hasburgs.
At the height of the scam, Tilly had two different apartments. He had one in New York City and one in London. Gonzalez was collecting rare and fine wines. He got a Rolex watch as a gift from Tilly for his support in this endeavor. And when Tilly was arrested, in his home, they found 34,000 euros in cash and valuable objects like lithographs, watches, bottles of wine, and a really outlandish wardrobe. Gonzalez had a BMW 645, $86,000 in euros in the trunk. And in the end, the De Vedrin family started with about 5 million euros, which is about $6.2 million. However, at the end of the scam, once they tracked down all the cash and assets, they were only able to recover about 220,000 euros, which is about $274,000. It's suspected that some of this money is somewhere in an offshore bank account in the Cayman Islands, and that it's probably unlikely to ever be recovered. But we see this massive fortune really cut into a small fraction, and even after this is solved, they weren't able to get everything back.
So once Tilly and Gonzalez were in custody, Picton set forth like exfiltrating the remaining family members. Jamie, what does that mean?
Yeah, so essentially they were indoctrinated, brainwashed. Essentially, they felt like they were in a cult that was being led by Tilly, and they were doing everything that he said to do. So for somebody to come in from the outside and try to break this up, I'm sure they were seen initially as the enemy. Like, Tilly told us this would happen. These people are coming for us. So they had to slowly work to bring this family to a realization of what had actually happened.
Yeah, and this would involve some counseling techniques that was pioneered by an American cult expert, Stephen Hassan, in 1978, after he freed himself from the Moon Unification Church. Now, Picton had to provoke a psychological disconnect in each family member. So he began by discussing details of their lives prior to their enslavement, and these simple memories attempt to disintegrate the web of influence that he had over them. They were able to bring Christine's son back to France, and a month later, the rest of the family were rescued. They all signed on as plaintiffs in the case, and Christine was bringing these charges against Tilly. Now, Charles and Christine reunited, and Guylaine moved back in with her ex-husband, John.
Tilly's trial would start on September 24th of 2012. Again, less than 10 years ago. He was charged with brainwashing, kidnapping, and torture, including acts of barbarianism. He denied any wrongdoing here. The prosecution essentially argued that Tilly used his superior intelligence, intellect, and charm to get close to the family. One of France's leading psychiatrists said that Tilly followed the unwritten playbook of the master manipulator, people that would start and lead cults and try to brainwash people. He took the family down these very four basic phases of being a manipulator. The first is identifying and prey on each family member's weaknesses, cultivate a paranoia mentality, which he did by telling them somebody was out to get them, have an answer for everything, which is something that a con man's really good at, thinking on your feet and coming up with things that you know they're going to believe, and then to start to break the family apart, dismantling those bonds like he did when he had everybody torture Christine. Because each family member started to doubt everything about their personal lives. So the defense at this trial for Tilly argued that the family did everything willingly. He claimed in court that he was a member of the Habsburg dynasty and that he almost played soccer professionally and that he had a personal relationship with the French president. So he's even claiming in court some of these outlandish things that he convinced the family of.
On November 13th, 2012, Tilly and Gonzalez were found guilty of brainwashing this family, and they had done so from 2001 to 2009. They would also be found guilty of kidnapping and torture with acts of barbarism. So Tilly was sentenced to 8 years. Gonzalez was sentenced to 4 years. Let's put a pin in that and come back to that, all right? In prison, Tilly gets very few visitors and has refused to see his father. His father appeared in court to set the record straight when it came to some of the lies that Tilly was saying. He clarified that he was never a commando driver, and his mother was a midwife and not a skating champion.
That's quite the different career path there. Today, the various members of the Dave and Dreen family rarely see one another. Christine remains upbeat despite missing sentimental items like poems, notes to her late parents, and relationship with her own kids. All this was in a suitcase that was taken to England, and nobody knows what Tilly did with any of these items that he took. They were never recovered. One of Christine's sons moved back to England and works in a bank. Another regularly meets with his psychiatrist, who's still helping him find his way out of this situation to get back on his feet in the real world. He ended up getting a business degree, so that's a step in the right direction. Charles Henry got his license back and has once again started practicing as a physician. But the most devastating part for him was realizing that Tilly had convinced him to sign over the papers to sell their family home, the Chateau Martel. They continue to appeal the sale of this mansion, fort, castle, place that they lived. And most recently, the legal action is against the notary who was there when they signed over the rights to sell this home. Again, this was their identity. This is where they hunkered down. But when they moved to England, Tilly was able to sell it. Charles Henry would say that he thought he was signing for a loan, not the sale of the home. He didn't know what he was signing over and had been tricked. And the notary should have caught that and not allowed the sale of this home. He says, I never would have knowingly sold Martel. I wasn't in my right mind, but I wouldn't have agreed to sell my family home that my and my children's heritage lived in. And I'll fight till my dying day to get it back.
Jamie, this case is wild. I hope you guys were able to kind of keep track of everything that was going on because it was a lot.
I mean, it's legitimately follows in some ways. It's like Tilly was trying to set them in motion of thinking that they were a part of this Dan Brown universe where the Da Vinci Code and angels and demons take place, that there was this group out to get them and that they had the keys inside of them to overcome it. Now, we talked about the Patty Hearst case with an element of brainwashing and leading to some dependency issues and certainly just a hard time coming back to a reality that they forgot that they had left altogether. So brainwashing is obviously something that happens, and it's amazingly unfortunate. And these family members were certainly the victim in all this. It's easy for somebody to say that would never happen to me, but this is a wealthy, intelligent, powerful family. If it's going to happen to them, it very well could happen to somebody else.
You know, I wonder, trying to put myself in this family's shoes and like, why would I develop so much trust for this guy that I barely know? But I wonder if it's because of how much they had, they wanted to protect it. So they became even more vulnerable in an attempt to try to protect what they had.
Yeah. I went over those steps of being a master manipulator. Hopefully that wasn't a how-to. I don't want anybody to enact those. But I think if you reflect on this story and even the Patty Hearst story, you can see some of those steps being put in place to gain that psychological edge. Similar tactics happen in domestic violence situations that we see gaslighting habits and things like that. So an amazingly unfortunate case, but it had so many twists and turns that made it, almost thrilling to try to keep up with and figure out where it was going to end. So thanks to Mackenzie for writing this one up for us. And thanks to you guys for hanging out while we covered it.
Yeah. Guys, we appreciate you all for not only your ratings and reviews, but taking time to check us out on Patreon. You guys are incredible. We're happy to do this for you. So those little things help us continue to do that.
We've been putting a lot of content out on TikTok, some previews, some other updates on cases. Go follow us over there. It's at True Crime Cast over on TikTok. Those videos are a lot of fun to make.
Yeah, you're also putting stuff on YouTube. Now, I know the True Crime to Goes are almost like on there in their entirety, but our Tuesday shows are kind of just snippets to introduce new people to the show and bring them over here.
Yeah, we'll do some sneak previews and again, some case updates. So make sure you follow us over there as well as Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Guys, we appreciate you. Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media.
Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.